Please welcome Professor Hod Lipson.
Thank you. A pleasure to be here tonight. I want to tell you a story about how we developed a kind of robotic scientist. Now, it's a kind of peculiar name. If you Google robotic scientist, you'll find all kind of interesting pictures, such as this one. But this is not really what I mean. What I really mean is a machine that can look at some physical device, such as a pendulum that swings, look at its data, collect the data, and just by looking at the data, derive something fundamental that underlays this behavior, something that governs the dynamic, something that we might call a physical law. So I won't go right ahead and tell you how this machine works and what it's doing and what it's not doing, but I want to tell you a little bit of a story about how we got there and how we became interested in this kind of question. And actually, most of our work in the lab is in robotics. We're trying to make machines that will learn and adapt to their environments. Now, most of the robots that are out there right now, there's millions of them, work in factories. And they are superhuman in their precision, in their speed, in their resilience, and their ability to work 24/7, in almost any way you want to measure it. But they lack one thing, and that is their ability to adapt to new situations. So if you take a robot like this in a factory, it will work well as long as the pieces are in the right place at the right time. But if something goes wrong, it's game over. If a bolt falls off the machine, it can't improvise. It can't do anything about it. So adaptation is one of these things that biology is great in doing. And that's what we want to learn. Now, I used to have to show a picture of a robot going to Mars and having to adapt with unforeseen situations, but really, this is entering our home. I don't know how many people here have a robot at home. Anybody here have a Roomba? Okay, a couple of brave souls. I have 5 of them at home. And actually, when you put 5 of them together, they don't clean that well. They kind of huddle in the corner. But these kind of robots really need to handle unforeseen situations. Okay, it's not as easy as a factory floor. The home changes all the time. My kids ride on the robot. Everything is up for grabs. So it's really a jungle out there, and robots need to adapt. So what can we do about it? So there's lots of approaches, and they're all based on this idea of learning, of machine learning, that you don't just design the machine and put it out there, but you let the machine learn from its experiences. And we took initially, the first project we did quite a while ago, maybe 10 years ago, was to say, let's take an extreme approach. Let's call in the mother of designers, evolution. Let's just throw in millions of pieces of robots, bars, connectors, joints, neurons, as in neural networks that can control these pieces, put them in a big soup, and just let evolution run on this. Let's get these pieces to connect together in arbitrary ways, in random ways, undergo mutation and selection, and gradually over thousands of generations, we might get some interesting robots that come out of it that can do something. So we set out this evolutionary process for a simple target, such as crawling across a table, and we got some interesting results, such as the robots here that kind of crawl across a table. In fact, some of these robots are really interesting. This one over here, for example, at the bottom, almost looks like it was intelligently designed. It's kind of it's symmetrical, and it's nicely, it kind of wiggles its tails as it moves and so forth. So you get interesting devices in simulation. This is all done in simulation. It was a big 16 processor Onyx at the time. Now you can probably run it on your cell phone, and you can get it. And the interesting thing is that we got some really interesting results, and they worked in reality. So here are 2 of these robots actually built and functioning in reality. Now, when you look at these robots, you have to remember they're not great in terms of robotics, but they were designed by this evolutionary process. We gave it the building blocks, and it kind of emerged spontaneously for this target task of crawling across a table. And we used a 3D printer to actually fabricate these robots. So these robots worked They transferred well from the simulation to reality because they were very simple. But that is not always the case. And if you want to make complex robots, it's going to be very difficult to simulate them. So our next project, where we tried to impress our robotics colleagues, was done with a much more sophisticated machine. This is a machine that has 12 pneumatic actuators with a paintball canister in the center. We put this robot in a cage, and we put a camera here on top. The camera can see this red ball here. This is the camera view. And now, instead of evolving robots, we're going to evolve controllers or brains of robots. They're going to take turns riding the machine like a rodeo. And those controllers that can make the robot move forward more get to crossbreed with other controllers and make offspring controllers that will then get to ride the controller until eventually we can get something that can make the robot move forward. So we tried that on a real machine, and here's a playback of this robot. Here you can see it's playing back some of its very initial runs. You see it's not going, it's not going very far. It's not going to take over the world anytime soon. And gradually it's learning how to walk from its experiences. And you can see that, you know, the idea here is, again, adaptation. So you throw a robot like this into a new environment, and we'll gradually learn how to walk through this kind of evolutionary process. And this time we have controllers evolving inside, a whole population of controllers evolving inside this brain of a single machine. So so let's look at these two projects that I just showed you. In the first one, we did everything in simulation. We then crossed our fingers, built the machine, and hoped that it worked. Okay, and it did work only because the robots were very, very simple. But in general, it's a very difficult approach because we have to cross what we call the reality gap between simulation and reality. Anybody doing engineering knows that things can work well in simulation. It doesn't mean they work in reality. And stuff happens in reality that's difficult to predict. So that's a general problem. The more sophisticated, the more complex the machines you're trying to create, the bigger the gap you need to cross. And the second project I showed you is a completely different approach. We said we'll skip the whole simulation. We're just going to evolve the behavior on the physical machine itself. The machine is going to interact with the world, and it's going to try out things and going to see what's going to work. That works. That bypasses the whole simulation. But the problem there is that it just takes too many physical trials. It just is too expensive and slow. And we proposed it to NASA, and there was no way they were going to let us run controllers randomly on a robot on Mars. No way. So you can't do these things on real robots. It's just too expensive, too slow, too risky for the robot, too energetically costly. So we're kind of stuck between these two approaches. If you do it in simulation, you have the reality gap. You do it in reality, it's too slow. So what do you do? So I want to show you a third approach. And this approach will kind of lead me to this idea of a robotic scientist. And I hope you see in a moment why. But let me first explain the basic idea. The basic idea is very simple. You start off with a simulator. But this simulator can be actually a pretty bad simulator. It doesn't have to be a good simulator. Just some kind of simulator. And you use it, let's say, to evolve robots or whatever it is you want to do. And then you take the best robot that you found, and you build it. You cross your fingers, and it doesn't work. Why? Because the robot wasn't very good. So you get your robot. Now, even though it doesn't work, you can collect data about this robot. And what kind of data you collect? You collect the data, the actuation, what the robot tried to do, and sensations, what the robot sensed. Pictures, accelerations, whatever it is the robot senses. And you take this data set, this actuations and sensations, and you use them to evolve better simulators. Okay, so now, whereas before we evolved robots, now we're going to evolve simulators. What's a figure of merit for a simulator? How well it retrospectively explains the relationship between actuation and sensation that the robot experienced. Now, of course, if the robot only did a small set of motions. You have a very small data set, and you're going to get lots and lots of simulators, but you take the best one you have, and you use it to evolve a new robot. Then you take that robot, you try it in reality again. Probably it's not going to work still, but you collect a little bit more data. You use that, these two sets of data now to improve your simulation. Then you take the new simulator and you do it in a cycle. So you're doing a lot of computation, but relatively few physical trials that kind of ground the simulator. And if you do this for a while, you get what we call we're evolving robots and we're evolving simulators. We have something like similar to co-evolution, two things competing, somewhat like predator and prey. Okay, robots use the simulators. The simulators need to explain what the robots are doing. The robots are utilizing what the simulators are predicting. So they're kind of dancing in a circle, and the whole thing hopefully lifts off, and you get what you want. So let me show an example of how this works. So this is another robot, and this robot has four legs. It has eight motors, two on each leg, one at the hip and one at the knee, and it has two tilt sensors that can tell it how it's tilted left and right, forward and backwards. Now, this robot is needs to learn how to walk. Now, the challenge is that this robot does not know what it looks like. You look at this robot, you can see it has four legs. But the robot itself does not know what it looks like. It does not know if it's a tree, if it's a snake, if it's a spider. It has no clue how the pieces are arranged, how the eight motors are configured. So to understand the challenge, imagine yourself sitting in a black box with no windows, and you have eight knobs. And you have to turn these eight knobs any which way, and as you turn them, you can feel the box tilting left and right, forward and backwards. And you need to make the box move forward in some way. So you can try turning the knobs randomly, and maybe you'll get somewhere, but there's probably a more efficient way to do this. And I think that perhaps this is not unlike what a brain of a newborn child feels when it has all these actuations and muscles and things it can control, and it has all the sensory data, and it has to figure out what it is. All right, so let's look at this robot and let's see what happens. So we set out the robot, and it's going to do initially a random motion. It's going to just do something, actuate its motors. Remember, it doesn't know what it looks like. It's going to sense, it's going to get sensations of how it's tilting left and right, forward and backwards, and then it's going to take that data set and it's going to try to figure out what it is. It's going to create hypotheses about what it is. And you can see at the top left a couple examples. Maybe it's a snake, maybe it's a tree. It's going to come up with all kinds of stick models that describe hypotheses about what its shape might be. Then it will look, and this is the critical step, it will look for the next action to do that causes the most disagreement between predictions of these models. Why? Because the action that causes the most disagreement between predictions of these models is the one that's going to generate the most information. It's somewhat like a scientist that designs an experiment that causes the most disagreement between predictions of two competing theories, because the result of that experiment will tell us at least one of these theories will have to be wrong, so it will refute at least one of them. And so it chooses the action that causes the most disagreement, and this is at the top right here, and then will physically carry it out. So remember, this is the second time around, and it will, a second physical experiment, it will do that experiment, get more data, refute some of these models, improve others, go again, look for actions that cause disagreement, and so forth, and we'll go in a circle, and gradually begin to narrow down these hypotheses. And of course, doing it in reality, it's never an exact match. There's noise. There's all kinds of issues it needs to deal with. But it's like a real scientist. In the end, it will take the models. It will keep on doing this until it cannot make these models disagree anymore. At that point, it will try to look for, let's say, a pattern that moves this model forward. And because the model will be pretty close to reality, what makes the model move forward will also make the robot move forward. Okay, so let's see what happens. So we tried this out. We plugged in the robot, and we let it do its thing, okay? And it's beginning to explore itself on the floor there, doing all kinds of random motions, and unplugged itself. And that's... You know, so the lesson there is you don't want to walk off a cliff just to see what it feels like, Okay, there's a limit to how much you want to explore behind, beyond what you know, right? So anyway, that wasn't planned. So we tamed the robot a little bit. We let it move just small amounts, and this is what happened. So this is the robot doing its first motion, and these are hypotheses that it's generating. Now, if you look at them, they're all wrong, because you happen to know the truth. But so far as the robot knows, they're all valid hypotheses because they all make the box in the center move in the same way. Here's an 8th out of 16 trials. You can see it's beginning to figure out it has 4 legs, but not quite. And this is the 16th out of 16 trials, and it actually figured out that it has 4 legs and how they're connected and where. Okay? And so then it took this internal model that it has and figured out how to move forward. Now, I confess we were really hoping that it's going to generate an evil spider Ewok, but instead, it generated this lame way of moving forward. All right, so now only I can hear this, but it's moving in a peculiar way, when you look at it, you have to remember this robot did not do trials of walking before this, nor did it have a model of itself, okay? It created a self-image and then used that self-image, which is a very simple self-image, to figure out how to move forward and so forth. And so we did a very cruel experiment, and we chopped off a leg. And let's see what happened. So when the leg was removed, the dynamics changed. And suddenly the robot's internal image also changed. It actually lost a leg internally. It didn't quite lose it, it just made it very short, because it still needs to explain where the motors are. And then it figured out how to move without that leg. So again, this is not the best way to move without a leg, but it's still interesting that it figured out a way to do so anyhow. And I want to emphasize that there isn't a sensor there that said, a leg came off, switch to plan B. Okay, this is all spontaneous. Leg comes off, dynamics change, self-model adapts, new behavior emerges. Okay, so this is all adaptation. All right, so every time you run it, you get a different result. So it's not necessarily an optimal behavior, but it's still adaptive. And if you run it 30 times, here's just some data. If you just use random controllers, you get these red dots from the origins. It doesn't go anywhere in particular. If you let it create self-models, it predicts it's going to get to where the black dots are, but where it actually gets is where the blue dots are, okay? So what does this mean? It means that the self-models that the robot created is inflated, but it's from academia, so a self-inflated model is fine. But the idea is that even an inflated model, even a wrong model, still sometimes is good because it can allow you to make decisions in the right direction. So we can see the actual physical reality was about half of what the models predicted, but still it was good enough that it could learn how to walk. All right, so I showed you a couple examples in robotics, and that's how we started. Remember, this is a story. And after we've been doing this for a while, we said, wait a minute, we can apply this to other things. You know, why stop at robots? There's lots of systems that have some interesting dynamics. They're in a black box. We can perturb their inputs, like we can turn the knobs. We can observe the outputs, and from the relationship between inputs and outputs, we want to determine what's inside the box. Now, the key is that we can control the inputs, okay? Like the robot can control its actions. So we have some say about what the system is doing. We're not just sitting back and watching a system offline. We can actually interact with it and interrogate it. So what can we do in some other areas? So imagine this general process now. So I replaced the picture of a robot with some test tubes, but it's the same idea. We have the robot here, the experimental systems. We can perturb it. We can set initial conditions. We can observe outputs. We collect the data, and then we come up with models. Now, in the robot case, we came up with models made out of simple building blocks of robots, okay, bars, joints, things like that. Now, let's create models made out of scientific building blocks, maybe pieces of equations, okay? And it could be anything that's relevant to whatever you want to investigate, but let's stick to math. We come up with lots of different models, the algorithm does, And then it looks for the next experiment that causes the most disagreement between predictions of these models. It then perturbs the system according to this maximum disagreement principle, observes new data, refutes some of the models, and continues in a cycle. So that's the basic idea, taken from the robot and applied to a more general system. So this is a bridge that I cross every time I walk into Cornell in the morning. And actually, right now, it looks more like this. And when you cross this bridge, you have a long time to wonder what would happen if one of these things were a little bit weaker than they should be. And so this is an ideal kind of thing where you can apply this kind of algorithm. So we did that in simulation, not in reality this time. We took the bridge, simulated a bridge. We weakened one of its bars a little bit. And then we let the bridge vibrate itself and figure out what it is. It came up with lots of models. And then it figured out how to vibrate itself again to cause the maximum disagreement between predictions of these models. And interestingly enough, within a fairly short while, it was able to identify the weakest link. And it could do that a lot faster and more accurately than traditional civil engineering approaches. So that's an example of how you can take this idea of the robot building a self-image, apply it to a structure, civil engineering structure, health monitoring, damage diagnosis, and so forth in a completely different domain. But I want to give you a really interesting example that has to do with how using this to actually do some analytical science. And that's kind of where this whole idea of a robotic scientist culminates. And before that, I want to say a couple of words about something that is called symbolic regression. And I'm sure that some of you know what regression is and statistical regression. But generally speaking, you take a mathematical model and you can use regression to fine-tune coefficients of that model, either a linear model or a nonlinear model. So usually you give the algorithm, the regression algorithm, the model, a mathematical model, and it just tunes the parameters. Symbolic regression is when you don't know, you actually don't care about the parameters. You want to know what's the form of the equation. You don't even know the form. So here's a couple of dots in a box. And I want you to think, if there were less people here, I'd do this exercise interactively, but we're going to do this rhetorically now. Let's look at these dots and try to think in your head, what's the mathematical equations that gave rise to these dots? Okay, so you're thinking about this and you're saying, there's a wave there. It's probably a sine or a cosine. It's also growing, so maybe there's a linear or exponent in there. And if you think about it for a while, you're probably going to realize that it's something like some exponent times a sine wave. And that's actually the correct answer, as I'm sure most of you knew. And when you look at this, if you tried to do this in your head, you were doing symbolic regression, because you didn't care about coefficients. You didn't care what's the value. If it's, you know, 2 or 1 or half, you just cared qualitatively what was going on, right? So this is called symbolic regression. And we can do that analytically using this evolutionary process. Just like I evolved robots from robot pieces, we can evolve equations from equation pieces. What are pieces of equations? Literally, plus, minus, plus, minus, divide, multiply, open brackets, close brackets, sine, cosine, numbers, variables, okay? So we put them together in what is called a parse tree, and we can evolve these trees, and each tree describes an equation. Okay, this, for example, this tree over here describes a particular equation, and we can evolve these trees and reward them. Instead of rewarding the robot for moving forward, we can reward the tree for how well it matches the data. And as these trees progress, they will gradually match the data, and we get our answer. Okay, so this data over here is explained best by this equation over here. So you can see how we can use this idea of evolving morphologies, shapes, to explain data. All right, so we can do that, but again, I want to emphasize it's not about just modeling the data. Remember, there was always the other side that was generating experiment to create disagreement between models. And so what we do is we evolve expressions to explain the data, and we also co-evolve experiments that extract data from the real system to create, they look for the thing that creates the most disagreement between predictions of models. So they look at all the population of models and see where they disagree, and that's where they go to do the experiment, okay? On purpose, they go where there is disagreement between the models, okay? Again, to refute some of the models. So these things kind of hop around, and they challenge each other in a kind of an arms race, okay? Models explain the data, and then data, and then a new experiment is automatically generated to try to create disagreement, and this whole thing cycles through. And so I showed you here an example of how we use it to extract models from data. But the really interesting thing is that you can also extract differential equations, which is a more kind of general kind of relationship. And what you do is you take your data and you compute its derivatives over time, and then you fit the equations to the derivatives. And then you get really descriptions of some dynamical systems purely from observations. So just to give you an example of how that might be useful, this is a black box. It's actually gray. And in this box, we put some equations of a biological system. Now, don't ask me what this is. I don't know. It's some complicated glycolysis cycle in a cell. Seven variables, lots of equations. I'm just showing it here so you can see it's complicated. And we use that to generate data synthetically. And then we give it to this algorithm and say, OK, given this data with a little bit of noise sprinkled on top, tell us what was in this black box. Okay, and secretly, we know what is in there, but we just want to test it. And indeed, it crunches on this for a day, and it comes up with these equations. And if you look at them, it matches pretty nicely. In fact, it got this thing wrong. It's wrong, but it's very small. So we have a really interesting tool that can look at this data and tell us what's the math that generated that data. Okay, so it's like a data mining tool, but for scientists, okay? Something that we can use. In this case, we could compare it, do all kinds of analysis, compare it to other techniques for modeling and so forth. But the interesting thing about this is that it's human readable. Okay, so it's not a neural network or something like that, it's a black box you can't quite understand. You can actually copy and paste this into a paper and pretend that you actually derived that by yourself, and nobody could know, all right? So, you know, I gave this talk, and this is where I would stop. And I would beg for data. Okay, I said, okay, it works on the synthetic systems. Give me some data. And you know, a lot of people would come after the talk and say, I have some data for you. But then I wouldn't hear from them. So people don't like to send over data. They kind of work on this data for a long time, and they don't send it over. But this one brave soul, Gural Sewell, for University of Texas Southwestern, came over and he said, I have the perfect data for you. I've been working on these bacteria. And again, don't ask me about the bacteria because I don't know anything about it. But he's been measuring the dynamics, metabolism of these bacteria. And the interesting thing is, whereas most biologists measure dynamics on vats of billions of cells, he measures them on single cells. So you can take a single cell and watch how certain nutrients or certain biochemicals or signals go up and down over time. Perfect. And he can do that for lots of different cells. And he just gave us this data and said, find out what the equations are. Perfect. And so this is what the data looks like, cell number one, cell number two. And he gave us 60 of these. And he said, OK, good luck. Call me. So we ran it for a week, all right? And we came up, in the end, with these equations. So I don't know. I sent him an email, and he immediately replied back and said, no, that's not it. Doesn't make any sense whatsoever. It's total garbage. And so we were very depressed, and we were thinking about it. Until some point, we thought, OK, maybe we're not giving it the right building blocks. We gave it plus, minus, divide, multiply. We gave it sine and cosine, which are totally irrelevant for biology. But we come from engineering, so we thought it's useful. But we missed something. We missed a very important building block for biology, and that's time delays. Time delays are very important in biological systems. So we threw in an extra building block. Remember, we can give it any building block we want. And bam, we got this equation. Now, I don't know anything about biology, but this has to be right. OK? It's simple. It's symmetrical, and it explains the data. Now, Gural looked at this and said, well, you know, we just published a paper in Science with these equations to describe the data. So if this explains the data with as much accuracy as this does, and it's simpler, then according to Occam's razor, it's closer to the truth, right? But the problem is that we have no clue what this means. And that's a problem. So we can't publish this, right? You can't just say, here's an equation, see ya, right? So we have to do something about this, and it's really a challenge. It's like going to an oracle asking for the solution and forgetting to ask, you know, how you got there, and you can't explain it. So maybe these are actually the same. I thought of giving this in the final, in a course, asking students to prove that these are identical. But so we don't know what this means. So we're really stuck on this problem. Anybody has an idea, let me know. And we're trying to kind of find ways to understand how these relate. And I think the relationship is, you know, it's somewhat like, so this encodes something that we don't yet understand, maybe a new principle or maybe something that we have yet to call, to name in some way. So we're still working on it, and stay tuned, and I think we know where it's going, but I'll tell you later. So, but the kind of from a pragmatic point of view, this new model explains new data. So Gural made new experiments, and he created new cells in different situations, and again, these expressions match perfectly. So again, I don't understand, but this is, it works, it means something. And again, you can see that every cell has different parameters. So we really are only looking for the form of the equation, and we don't care of the parameter. The parameters can be different for different types of cells. All right. So I want to kind of conclude this with what I think is a kind of deeper quest, and that is the quest for invariance. Now, what's an invariance? Everything I showed you so far was about generating analytical models, symbolic models that explain data. So it's an explicit equation. Here's the data, and here's the equation that matches it exactly. Okay, it's nothing, it's kind of one-to-one. But a deeper quest is to look for what is not changing about data. Okay, so imagine, for example, you have things going up and down and fluctuating, and everything's moving, but you want to know what is not changing about the data. Maybe the sum of all the variables is always constant. Maybe the difference between variables is a constant. Maybe the ratio is always constant. You can try to look what is constant about the data. And the idea that doing that can reveal underlying principles. I want to give you an example. Let's say you take a pendulum that swings back and forth, and you measure the angle as function of time and the angular velocity as function of time. And you get these things going up and down, and you ask what's not changing about it. So you can, if you just generate a model, you will get sine and cosine, and that's it. That's all you get to learn about this pendulum as it moves forward. Let's assume it's a pendulum, it's a frictionless pendulum, so it keeps on going. But if you take the data and you ask what's not changing about it, what will you get? It's energy. Okay, you get a complicated equation that is the sum of the potential energy and the kinetic energy, and that's what's not changing about the pendulum. So by doing so, even if you knew nothing about energy, you get to see an underlying principle that governs the behavior of the pendulum. And so by looking at invariance, looking for what is not changing, can give you a little bit more insight into the governing laws of the system. And so that's what we're after. And it's a bit tricky to do. For example, here's another example. Here's a bunch of points, and you ask what's not changing about these points. And let's say they're all kind of on a unit circle. And so what's not changing about them is that their coordinates kind of add up to be on an equation of a circle. So that's an example of an invariant that describes these dots roughly. And so this is something we want to do. We want to look for invariants. Now, It's tricky because if you ask a computer to find something that is not changing about the data, something that is constant, you just reward it for things that are constant. It crunches for exactly 1 second and it comes up with an answer. The answer is 42. 42 is not changing about the data. So you say, okay, wait a minute. I want you to find an equation that is a function of the variables but is not changing. So it crunches exactly 1 second more, and it says x minus x is not changing. Okay, so that doesn't work. Okay, so it's really difficult to ask to find a criteria that will give you something that is invariant yet meaningful, and that is the challenge in looking at invariants. And so here's the basic idea. I won't go into too many details, but the basic idea is you take your data stream, and you can compute the derivatives of the data again, how x changes over time and how y changes over time. And in fact, you compute how x changes as a function of y and how y changes as a function of x. These are called kind of implicit derivatives. And you can do the same thing with the candidate equations. Remember revolving equations. You compute how the partial derivatives, how f changes with x and how f changes with y, and the ratio between them tells you how x changes with y and y with x. And then you compare these implicit predictions with the data, and that's your reward function. So that's the gist of the idea. There's details in implementing this, and we set it off to see what happens. So first thing we gave it is that circle. And it comes up with the equation of the circle. We give it something a little bit more complicated. From a textbook, it comes up with these. So, okay, it looks like it's doing what it needs to do. So let's try it on some real data. So anybody who's done physics or engineering is familiar with physics 101 lab, where you take one of these carts on an air track, and you have to derive what's happening. So we put this red sticker and a webcam, and it watches this sticker, and it has to tell us what's not changing about this cart. Okay, so this is what it actually looks like. It's kind of a simple program with a webcam. It's looking at this, you know, so this is not changing, nothing's changing, but this is moving. It's collecting the data, kind of very simple setup, and it tries to calculate what is not changing about it. And it turns out that this is not changing about it. Now, as I'm sure you all know, this is the Hamiltonian of a pendulum, of a oscillator. So what this basically means is that it's the term used to describe the total energy of this thing, exactly like a pendulum. So it found out something interesting. And we ran it again, it comes up with a Lagrangian and other things. Every time we run it, it comes up with different things. And it actually came up with other things that we don't know what they are. So there's some naming opportunities out there if you're looking for something. All right, the dean is very interested in this. So we ran it here on just a regular pendulum like I showed you before, and it comes up again with these things which are not changing about the pendulum. Again, happens to be the Hamiltonian and Lagrangian of the pendulum for the physicists amongst you. And so we said, okay, let's kick it up a notch. Let's take a double linear oscillator. So this is kind of the last experiment in Physics 101. It's a crazy thing. It has two carts with kind of three springs. And this is what's going on when you track these things. Now, when you look at this, you know, what's not changing about this? Okay, this is really, you know, crazy dynamics, okay? What's not changing about it? Well, it turns out that this is not changing about it. And this turns out to be, again, the total energy of the system, something that's interesting. And you get the Lagrangian as well. So the ultimate kind of system in dynamics, one of the really hard ones, is called the double pendulum. I wanted to bring one here, but I forgot. It's a really, it's kind of crazy motion, really kind of unpredictable. And so we put a camera to track this thing, measure four variables, the velocities and the angles over time, and try to figure out what is going on. And this is the data. This is the real data that came out of this double pendulum, kind of very crazy data. And we wanted the computer to look at this and tell us what's not changing about this system. Now, this is really crazy. Okay, what's not changing about this? And I challenge any of you to do that right now. And this is, again, what's not changing. And what's interesting here is that you get all kinds of things. You get happens to be the Lagrangian of a double pendulum, which takes a graduate degree in physics to figure out. And it's important that the machine did this with knowing nothing about physics, about geometry, about kinematics. Okay, only thing he knew is that he has to find out what's not changing given plus, minus, divide, multiply, sine, and cosine. These are the building blocks. It took it about a day to do on 32 cores, so it's not unreasonable. We'll be on your cell phone in a couple of years. All right, so it's really interesting, and what you get is this kind of interesting relationship between between the kind of parsimony of the equation and its accuracy. And that's very typical of any machine learning method. It doesn't just come up with one solution. It basically tells you, okay, I found a dozen equations. Some of them are accurate but complex. Some of them are simple, but they're not very accurate. You choose. Okay, it gives you this whole series. And indeed, for the double pendulum, it gave us conservation of energy, gave us conservation of momentum, which is true for when it's in high energy, but not true when it's in low energy. It gave us the fact that the pendulum, some of it was going on an arc. All kinds of interesting things it discovered about this process. So again, to emphasize, it's a data mining tool. So it doesn't give you the ultimate result right away. It just finds interesting things. So data mining, is very popular in business. You take what people buy in a supermarket, you analyze it, and you find out that, let's say, people who buy diapers on Thursdays also buy beer. So that's what the computer finds out, and you place the beer next to the diapers to increase your revenue. So that's what data mining is business. You don't need to understand why. You just need to follow the recommendations. And this is a kind of the same thing. It's exploratory. Sometimes it finds, sometimes it doesn't find. If it finds something, you have to figure out what's underlying it, what does it mean. All right, so the interesting thing, this is the equation that it came up with, and of course they didn't know what the coefficients are, but here's a nice trick. If you run the system on lots of different pendulums with different masses and different lengths of arms and things like that, you can actually figure out that how these coefficients depend on these things, and it can come up with these relationships which actually give you what these actual coefficients are in a way that's, again, meaningful from a physics point of view. So it actually can give you the whole thing, the whole equation that governs the dynamics, which, again, in this case, is something that's well known. So, again, we go from the behavior, from the dynamics, all the way to an equation without having told the system anything about physics and so forth. And we can apply this to other systems. And, again, I don't know what this means, but it means something. And, I'm always asked, okay, can I discover something new that nobody knows? Well, this is something new, but nobody knew. But again, we're faced with this new conundrum, which is it's find something new, but we don't know what it means, and we can't publish it. So this is, I think, going to be a trick. It's a preview of what science is going to be like. So you can try this at home. When we first published this, we got lots of emails from mostly grad students. I've been working on this data for 5 years. Please find something in it. And so we began to do this. Actually, there's an interesting story. We got an email from somebody in CERN, Particle Accelerator, and they said, there's some discrepancies between the masses of particles and energies or something. I don't understand. Can you find the equation? And so, sure, it sounds like a Nobel Prize right around the corner. So we did this, we ran the algorithm, and it came up with this beautiful equation. So we emailed them quickly, CCing a couple other people, just in case. And they said immediately, well, we knew that. And it's so-and-so's equation. So it's a well-known relationship. So they were disappointed because we rediscovered something. But we were very excited because they found something that is named. Okay, so it means that maybe there's hope and it's going to find something else. So But anyway, we got a lot of these emails, and eventually we became the bottleneck because we couldn't analyze so much data. So we put the program online, and you're welcome to download it. It's called Eureka with a Q because K was taken. And you can download it and try it out. So it looks like an Excel spreadsheet. You just dump your data, and you press the find relationship, and it crunches on your data, and it will do its best. And you have some options. You can select which building blocks you want to give it and so forth, and it will try to do its best. And it will give you a set of equations that presumably match the data. So it's interesting. Of course, we don't know what people run on this. They just download it. But sometimes they come back with questions, and it's kind of peculiar to see what people do. Some, you know, the coolest example is somebody trying to find out the behaviors of cows in a herd. It's really, I thought, interesting. And there's, of course, a lot of people trying to do, guess what, the stock market, right? We tried it too, and I'm here, so that means we didn't find anything. But probably it's not because there isn't a pattern, it's because we didn't give it the right building blocks. So remember, when we did the biology, if we didn't give it the right building block, the time delay, it found garbage, right? Probably for the stock market, we're not giving it the right data, because I did see a long blog of people discussing it, and there was a lot of activity, and then the whole blog was deleted. So I'm pretty sure somebody found something, and we'll see. All right. So we know that evolution cannot generate Shakespeare, but can it generate Hamiltonians? I mean, is it evolvable? And people will say, well, you know, you can't evolve science. It's this big discovery. It happens spontaneously, and there's no incremental path to discoveries. And I beg to differ. I think there is a lot of small steps you can take. It. Even when we look at the equations, which don't seem like they're evolvable, they are. Here's an example. The blue is the data, and the red is the equation. And this is the first equation. After a couple of generations, here's a better equation. Here's a better one. It gradually approximates the data until it gets it right. So it's evolvable. It can be found in small incremental steps, even though it doesn't look that intuitively. So I want to conclude with kind of the issue of scalability. You know, how does it scale to more complex systems? And you can sleep through an entire talk about artificial intelligence, and when you wake up in the end, when the applause wake you up, you can raise your hand and you can ask, how does this scale to complex systems? And it doesn't matter what the person talked about, that's a hard question to answer. Okay? Let's remember that if you need to do it to somebody. And so I want to talk a little bit about scaling, and you know, it doesn't it scales kind of linearly with the number of equations, but exponentially with the complexity for those of you who are familiar with these sorts of things. But the really interesting thing is that when you do an analysis, you don't just look at the results, but you look at the alphabet that is generated. So here's, let's say we run this algorithm on lots of pendulums and carts and springs and all kinds of things, and then we look at the data and ask, what kind of terms did you find with high frequency? What are the motifs? What kind of terms came up more frequently than you would expect just from their size? And that means that they mean something. And indeed, if you do this kind of analysis, you find that suddenly terms of kinetic energy, conservation of momentum, all kinds of interesting terms that are meaningful in physics come out of this. And so you're beginning not just to get an explanation of what's going on, but you get the alphabet that describes the set of systems that you looked at. And then when you use these things as your building blocks, not just sine and cosine, the system can solve more complex things a lot faster. And so the idea is that just like regular science, you can't just reach for the most complex system right away. You have to solve lots of simpler ones. Let the system find the alphabet, use that to bootstrap, and gradually find more complex systems. So to conclude, this kind of interesting kind of remarks on where this is going. This is something that was published in Wired, actually a couple of weeks before we published our stuff. And the claim was that in You know, today's world, correlation is enough, and science is obsolete. And the idea is that you don't need to have models. You just look it up. There's so much data. There's petabytes of data. Surely what you're looking for is already being seen. You just look it up in this big telephone directory. And we can stop looking for models. And, you know, I beg to disagree in the sense, yes, we have a lot of data, but we can use that data still to generate lots of models. And I think that this data can accelerate our ability to hypothesize, model, and test, but we need to find a way to automate it because right now the means of generating data are far exceed our capabilities for analyzing it. And finally, the kind of New York Times main publisher just quickly said, you know, scientists are replacing themselves. And you know, that couldn't be further from the truth. And as you can see, we still can't understand what these equations mean. So as scientists, we need to give the system the building blocks. We need to choose what data to give the system, and we need to interpret the result. And so I really see this as a kind of a data mining tool that can let us accelerate our exploration, accelerate hypotheses, come up with new frameworks and test them in reality. But still, there is the problem of identifying the meaning of it all. And I see that as one of the biggest, you know, next challenges of artificial intelligence is not just to discover things, but to explain it to humans. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Lipson. That was fantastic. At this time, we would like to open the floor to the audience for questions.
So, well, actually, I wanted to come back a little bit to those complex systems. So have you tried any kind of experiments or, I mean, calculations with data coming from, like, ecosystem-like situations with tipping points and, you know, changing dramatically things, like, in really complex systems?
Well, you can argue that the double pendulum is a very chaotic system with lots of tipping points and bifurcations and things like that. And actually, by looking for invariants, it's actually a way, you know, you're looking for a, you're not looking for making predictions, you're looking for what is not changing. And so you actually can ignore these bifurcations. So it works. So double pendulum is the ideal, is a textbook example of a system that you could describe. But of course, there are more complex systems, and it will be interesting to see what happens.
Evolutionary biologists argue that learning in animals and humans is a way to speed up adaptation. How do you argue against the idea that having robotics go back to evolution is somewhat of a step backwards?
Well, we're using evolution in the lifetime of the robot. So it's the same robot, and we're using evolution as a means of learning. So, you know, we could replace the evolutionary process where it's looking for self-models. We could replace that with other types of search that might better qualify for the term learning. But I think that in general, it's evolution is a type of learning. If you execute it over billions of years, it's, you know, the biological evolution. But if you execute it in a lifetime, the individual is, you know, what we call traditional learning. So it's learning.
Well, first, I'd like to thank you, I think, on behalf of everybody for a really interesting talk. Your concept of finding invariants, have you ever thought about taking symmetries and various things like that and giving this models where you know you have certain invariants and things like that, and then seeing how well it deals with things which are past, say, Hamiltonians and Lagrangians?
Yeah, absolutely. So a lot of this boils down to what kind of building blocks you give it. And so you could give it building blocks of symmetry. Basically, for example, giving it a building block of sines and cosine is telling something that, you know, we think it's relevant. And you can look at symmetries. You can give it building blocks of symmetries, of regularity, you can hierarchy, all kinds of different things that you think are relevant. and see what comes out. So there's many ways to seed the system with prior knowledge, prior assumptions, and see what happens.
Hi. It would seem like the natural kind of progression of machine intelligence, computational capability, robotics would lead to a singularity at some point in the near future. And I'm just wondering if you would comment on whether or not where you see that going. Do you see a singularity on the horizon? And if so, when?
Well, so singularity is one of these topics like consciousness, which we're prohibited from talking about. But that's what tenure is for, right? So singularity is, as I think, one of these concepts, and for those of you not familiar with it, this is the idea that as machines get smarter and smarter, at some point they become smarter than humans. At that point, they can improve themselves without humans, and it's game over. So I think the truth of the matter is that singularity happens piecemeal in different areas. So computers can play better chess than humans, can drive the car faster than humans. And so it happens in small scales. And I think this is a good example of such a case for some parts of data where computers can look at data and find relationships faster than humans, or maybe more complex relationships than humans. But I think what is interesting is that we don't understand these relationships. And it gives you a glimpse of what's going to be the next thing after the singularity, which is trying to find algorithms that can take the solution and explain it back to the human. And I think that will be kind of what's going to happen. So we are actually trying to work on this. So we gave up on trying to understand the biological expression just by looking at it. And we're trying to write algorithms that try to explain it to us. Now, how do they do that? It's a little bit like trying to explain to a child something. So you know what the child knows, and you try to explain by analogy. You say, well, this complicated thing, you know what an apple is, and you know what a dog is. It's like an apple. It's a little bit like a dog. And you explain it by analogy. So we're trying to write these kinds of algorithms to try to explain it to humans. And whereas we had machine learning up to now, I think after the singularity, we'll have machine teaching, where the computer needs to find a way to explain it to the human, which might be eventually very difficult. It might be as hopeless as trying to explain Shakespeare to a dog. But we're going to give it a shot.
I think we have time for one last question.
There's a lot of people who think autism for children, when children have autism, some people think it's a purely mental, cognitive thing. And I was impressed by how your robot learned to walk, but I'd be more interested in seeing how your robot diverges from the idea of walking the same way an autistic child would diverge from communicating or learning languages. And people say their learning goes non-mainstream, non-standard. Would your system be used to help understand why autistic children go on a non-standard learning curve?
So that question is above my pay grade. I don't know how to answer that, but I can say something related, and that is I gave this talk in a neuroscience conference, and somebody said, well, this is schizophrenia. The robot creates a self-model, and what happens when the self-model is wrong? Because, you know, for us, it's a bug. It doesn't work. We start it over. But when the self-model is wrong, the robot believes it has an arm somewhere where it doesn't, or its arm is shorter than it is. It has a phantom limb or something like that. And suddenly there's these interesting relationships between things you can see in humans and something you see in a robot. So, of course, humans are much more complicated and it's dangerous to make immediate correlations, but you can look at these very simple systems, how they self-model, and you can maybe draw analogies, and you might learn something. We have a very simple system, very transparent, and we can start asking the questions of the sort that you just asked on this very simple and transparent system, and maybe that's a way to get some insight.
Thank you. Please join me in thanking Dr. Lipson once again.
Thank you. Thank you.